Today is Monday, February 22nd, 2010. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. Today on The Wildlife, I'll play the first of a two-part interview with wildlife veterinarian Steve Osofsky. Today we'll talk about his adventures as the first wildlife vet in Botswana. We'll hear some captivating stories, like how he played MacGyver to make do with locally available materials so that he could run medical tests on some eland, to when he stared down an angry elephant whose head had entered his helicopter before he did. But first, let me play you today's creature call. For this week's creature call, we go to the plains of Africa where this large mammal lives. Now listen carefully and see if you can guess today's creature call. At the end of the show, I'll play these sounds again, tell you what kind of animal made them, and also give you a preview of next week's creature call. Now, let me turn to my conversation with wildlife vet Steve Osofsky. I first met Steve in 1993 while I was living in Botswana doing research for my PhD. If you've never been, Botswana is an amazing country and a magical place. From the Okavango River Delta in the northwest corner of the country, to Chobe National Park in the northeast, to the Kalahari Desert and Makatikati Pans in the center, much of the country teems with wildlife, from elephants and lions and wildebeest, giraffes, you name it. For a wildlife vet like Dr. Osofsky, being Botswana's wildlife vet was a dream job. He had a lot of experience before he landed the position. As a Harvard University traveling fellow, he traveled throughout East Africa in the mid-1980s and also worked for years at the Fossil Rim Wildlife Center in Glenrose, Texas, as the director of animal health services, where he cared for a variety of exotic game. So, when he moved to Botswana in 1991 and became the first wildlife veterinary officer for Botswana's Department of Wildlife and National Parks, he was thrilled. Since leaving Botswana, Dr. Osofsky's career has expanded well outside the bounds of a traditional veterinary clinical career into a variety of policy positions, including at the U.S. Agency for International Development and World Wildlife Fund. For the past 8 years, since 2002, he's been at the Wildlife Conservation Society, first as that organization's first senior policy advisor for wildlife health, and now as director of wildlife health policy. And we'll talk more about that next time. But for today, we'll concentrate on his experiences as the first wildlife vet in Botswana. When we talked a few weeks ago, I started by asking Steve how he got the job.
It's certainly an interesting situation in that, you know, ever since I was a little kid watching Wild Kingdom, the original Wild Kingdom, which speaks to my age, this was my fantasy job. And I went to college and veterinary school with that in mind. And after getting what I thought was the right amount of baseline training, which involved doing an internship in small animal medicine and surgery, as well as doing some extra training in field immobilization and wildlife management related work in the zoological community, I wrote dozens and dozens of letters to African wildlife departments. This was admittedly before email, and I literally wrote hard copy letters, and out of 20, 30, 40 letters probably, few countries actually answered, and Botswana was one of them. So I plotted out on a map, you know, which countries I would visit to, you know, further explore the responses I'd gotten, and Botswana was the first place I wanted to visit. I had just seen a wonderful National Geographic issue, I think it was in 1990, that really had a focus on the Okavango and on Botswana.
I know just that issue because that's what influenced me to do my dissertation research in Botswana, that same one with the hippo.
Exactly. I have it on my shelf here, and that's why we were there at roughly the same time, probably. Anyway, I went to Botswana and met with the deputy director of wildlife who had answered my letter. And they had apparently, turns out, I didn't know this till I got there, they'd had a vacancy for a wildlife veterinarian for years. And it really wasn't at all clear to me why it had never been filled, because from a veterinarian's point of view, this was the dream job. You know, Botswana has you know, when I think about the last great places for free-ranging wildlife, I think of places like Botswana and Tanzania. And now we're hearing a lot about South Sudan, but that's relatively newly unveiled. Anyway, they basically said, look, why don't you do a mini consultancy for us, and we'll see what we think of your evaluation. And they asked me to go off to an experimental game ranch that they had, and to look at why it was having problems. And without going into great detail, I did go off to this game ranch where they were trying to basically domesticate eland, and I think they had some ostriches. I can't remember what else.
Can you describe what eland are? They're a large antelope.
Yeah, eland are large bovid antelope. And over the millennia, there have been many attempts at domesticating them for things like meat production, etc. And for a lot of reasons, that's never really been successful, and it wasn't successful in this game ranch either. And I wrote a very, honest report of the problems that I witnessed, and they seemed to value it. They said, "Oh, well, we hadn't really thought about this, that, and the other." You know, when I went out there, you know, they had nothing. They had no equipment. And one of the obvious things is this: these animals were confined in an area much too densely, and they were, you know, clearly not doing well. They're very thin, and so one of the most basic things you can do is look at their parasite loads. So I had a field microscope that, you know, I used a mirror, didn't require electricity, and I needed to collect some fecal material from the various animals out there and then mix them up in a sugar solution, which I didn't carry with me. So I asked the guys if I could borrow the sugar that they used for their tea, and they loved this. It was kind of like a magic show. So I took the sugar and I made a super saturated solution. And then what we do is we float the feces for a certain amount of time in a solution, and then the eggs of parasites float to the top. And so I did this rigmarole in front of these guys.
Just with normal sugar, a sugar solution.
Yeah, I mean, there's various types of solutions you can use, but for what I was looking at, sugar was fine. And then I showed these guys what I saw under the microscope, which was huge numbers of parasite eggs from various worms that were plaguing these animals. Largely because they were so densely compacted, they were basically constantly re-eating parasites from the ground because there was no hygiene. Anyway, these guys thought this was really cool. They'd never seen a microscope before, and they'd certainly never seen parasites. But here, this guy took their sugar and did this neat test. And so that was part of the fun. And one of the things that was very...
When was this? This was 1990?
This was 1991. That's when I first went out there. And, you know, I had done so much training in the States, and the reason I did an academic internship was to really learn sort of the Mercedes way of doing things, because I was pretty sure if I was successful in landing a position in Africa, I'd really have to make do with locally available materials. I wouldn't have all the high-tech equipment and stuff, and that thinking really did prove to be valuable, because I really did learn when I was in the States – you know, the best way to do different diagnostics and medicine and surgery. But I often didn't have all those resources subsequently when I was in Africa. And I felt like I was able to make do and extrapolate from my experiences. And even in that very first site visit to that game ranch, that was clearly the case.
So it's sort of like a modern day MacGyver.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. Anyway, they basically said, okay, well, why don't you apply for our position? And then it became very clear to me why this vacancy had existed. This vacancy in the most exciting place for wildlife in Southern Africa wasn't filled because it was so darn hard to navigate the government of Botswana bureaucracy. And what I heard was that people had applied in the past by filling in forms and mailing them in. But it became very clear to me that that would never work. So what I ended up doing was shuttling my application forms from government office to government office, and it would take months. So I would go off, I'd drop it off at, you know, office X that had to approve some section of it. And then while I was waiting for them to process it, I started to tour the country, and I was hitchhiking around. I didn't even have a vehicle. You know, I'd find a Peace Corps volunteer who was going up to National Park X or whatever. And I started to see the country and backpack around, and it was just inspiring because it's such a beautiful country. Then I'd come back to Habaroni, the capital, to check in on my application. And, you know, and I would go to the Office of Personnel Management. And I would say, you know, Makati, how is my application? Dr. Steve, we cannot find your application. And this would happen over and over again. So I'd fill it out again. And one time I went in to see, you know, whoever it was, you know, my proverbial Makati. And I leaned on her desk and I said, "Ah, Makati, my application, it is lost again, isn't it?" And she said, "Ah, yes." And then I said, I noticed, this is a true story, I noticed that the table that I was leaning on wasn't rocking like it had last time. And I leaned on the table and I looked down, and sure enough, there was my application folder holding up a leg of the table. And I said, "Ah, Makati, look, I have such good fortune today. I have found my application." And indeed, I was able to hand her the folder, and she was able to put whatever stamp she needed to stamp on it and sign it and move it through the system. This took, I think, 3 or 4 months.
But it served a good purpose.
It did. I learned a lot about the government bureaucracy, and I also learned why no one had ever successfully gotten this job. So I got through all of that, and then there was this last stage. And again, this took months. And I had gotten some funding from my previous employer, from the Fossil Rim Wildlife Foundation, to sustain me while I was navigating this, which was great. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to do it. And so the last stage was a formal interview with the head of the Department of Animal Health and Production. And I won't name names. This was many years ago. But the veterinarian who was in charge at that time, he was a fairly volatile character. Let's put it that way. He had some issues. And it was a very loud interview with lots of screaming, some of it incoherent. But it was very interesting. And I managed to get through it. I explained my experience and the wildlife work I'd done and the training that I'd done and who I'd trained and the different courses I'd helped teach. And I think I won him over because he signed off, and I became the first veterinarian for the Botswana Department of Wildlife and National Parks, which became a real honor.
Was it unusual to have an American within the government?
Yes. I mean, there were quite a few Americans and other expats in Botswana government, all of them basically on expat contracts, either with the EU or USAID or the World Bank. I was a direct employee of the government of Botswana. I didn't have any external support. I wasn't with USAID or anyone else. So I was a line government officer, which was also very, very useful in many ways in terms of learning the system and understanding what it's like to work in that bureaucracy. In other words, I didn't have any other institution to fall back on. If things weren't working out, I really had to work within the system. And that meant also, because there'd never been a veterinary unit before, starting from zero. So it was really the opportunity to create a veterinary program for the wildlife department. Everything, you know, from figuring out what supplies to get to figuring out how to get them, to figuring out how to navigate the government's budget system and get all the approvals. It was really very trying in terms of navigating the system, but also very rewarding because I knew that no one had done it before, and the need was obviously great in terms of the technical resources that they needed to apply to their conservation problems.
So what were some of the first things that you did? I mean, I can only imagine navigating the U.S. budget system, so navigating the Botswana budget system.
Well, I mean, it was very interesting at the time. As you know, Botswana, a lot of their government functions based on the revenues from diamonds. And in the early 1990s, things were pretty good in Botswana in terms of both the diamond revenues as well as the valuation of the pula, their currency. At the time, it was 2 pula per dollar. I think today it's probably – I haven't been in about a year, but I think it's like 8 pula per dollar. So it's – things have changed. So I had to create a list of the supplies that were needed and a staffing structure that I envisioned. And very quickly, while I was trying to set this up, all of a sudden there were requests for assistance. People needed to immobilize animals and put radio collars on. And in the past, what had happened in the past, because some of this research work obviously was going on without a veterinarian in this position, years ago, biologists had been able to get permission to use dangerous drugs. And there were several high-profile accidents, all of them before my time. But I had heard, for example, that during some lion work, some darts that were being used had exploded in a helicopter and spilled on the pilot and the people using it and created quite a mess and a dangerous mess.
Wow.
And then there had been some deaths of animals, particularly elephants, because the biologists who were catching them didn't have the proper training. You know, immobilizing animals, field anesthesia – look, you see it on TV. It looks easy. You dart an animal, it falls asleep. And it's great if everything goes well, but really the veterinary input is in really understanding what you're doing and how those drugs are functioning, particularly if things don't go as planned. And since we're dealing with free-ranging wildlife, you can't, like you will in a small animal clinic or in a human hospital, tell the patient not to eat 24 hours before the procedure, for example. And you can't tell them not to land in the wrong position or in a river when they're falling asleep. There's all kinds of things you have to think about. And as a wildlife veterinarian, I was pretty well trained to anticipate and ideally prevent some of the things that were happening in Botswana and other places without having the right technical expertise at hand. So while I was trying to set up the unit, I was also getting requests. So I very quickly had to get supplies, get darts, get dart guns, get drugs, get to know who the players were. And one of the things that happened fairly early on is the government, as part of creating this position, decided, and I agreed, that all the captures that were going on for research would now have to be run through my office, which was really quite useful. I think some of the biologists, many of them, you know, private PhD researchers and things, weren't too pleased. But it at least created a mechanism for me as the head of the wildlife veterinary program to know who was doing what and how. And as these requests now had to come through me, I would then go out and assist each project and develop protocols, often to replace the ones that they were using, you know, updating them and, you know, instilling more rigorous safety procedures, both for the people and the animals. And so all of a sudden, I was running all over the country, assisting and mobilizing animals and helping with research, and at the same time building my own research program, because anyone who works in this business knows it's really an honor to have the opportunity to handle a wild cheetah or a wild elephant or whatever the species. And so we maximize that opportunity, collect a full complement of biological samples from parasites to feces to blood, and I was able to start collecting a huge database as well as bank samples to start to get a better understanding of the health issues affecting various species across the country, which again had really not been done. And it was a wide open field in terms of both the management needs that we were addressing, particularly in terms of the wildlife-livestock interface, as well as the research questions that we thought were important to the mission of the country's conservation goals.
And so what were some of the wildlife management issues at that time?
One of the biggest challenges, and it's still true today, was the growth of the elephant population. Botswana has the largest population of elephants in Africa, and there's conflict. There's lots of human-wildlife conflict as elephants and people who are farming are looking at the same sources of land and the same sources of water. So part of the program at that time was to get a better handle on elephant habitat utilization patterns and migration patterns, and this involved radio telemetry and looking at where elephants really needed to be at certain times of year. And that's really important information. If conservation is one of your main economic engines, which is the case in Botswana, you know, livestock production and nature-based activities are hugely important to the economy. They were then and continue to be now. To have informed land use planning, you really got to know what are the places that wildlife needs. In many countries, national park boundaries have been drawn historically around places that farmers didn't want, but they weren't drawn around places that we knew were ecologically important. In other words, there are many places that wildlife often need at different times of year that didn't necessarily make it into the boundaries of a particular national park. So many countries are now grappling with this reality, this mismatch between designation of protected areas and what habitat areas are actually necessary for sustained conservation success. And so there was a lot of telemetry work at the time. We were also doing a lot of work in the central Kalahari. A lot of the elephant work was obviously in the northern part of the country around Chobe and Maremi and the Okavango Delta. Farther south in the central Kalahari, we were looking at the movements of wildebeest and other species. And there's a long history of conflict between the fencing put in place to keep wildlife and livestock separate in order to keep foot and mouth disease out of livestock to allow exports to Europe. And the conflict being with those fences cutting off migratory routes and affecting the wildlife resource.
So this pattern of fences, for people who don't know, it would be great to describe. It's these veterinary cordon fences go all throughout the country to control movements of wildebeest and keep wildebeest away from and other wild bovids away from the livestock, correct?
Yeah, it's the big fear is the buffalo. The African buffalo is the natural reservoir of the virus foot and mouth disease. And foot and mouth disease, you know, is that disease that broke out in the United Kingdom a few years ago and caused, I think, over $1 billion all told worth of damage to the economy, including it led to the suicide of many farmers over there. It's an important disease from an agricultural point of view. It doesn't affect people, but it affects their livelihoods. And so going back to the late 50s and early 60s, colonial powers and early African governments in the region really were looking for ways to help poor countries develop some economic traction. And one of the obvious things to do was to try and create the ability to export foot and mouth disease free beef to largely a European market, because that's where a lot of the colonial powers were. So this was, you know, there was definitely economic self-interest on the part of, you know, the British and others at that time. And so in that context, I could understand what they were doing. Wildlife at that time really wasn't seen as the resource it's valued as today. And so there was no such thing really as a significant environmental impact assessment. So hundreds of miles of fences were built, as you said, to keep wildlife and livestock separate because of this disease issue. Now, fast forward to today, where wildlife in many parts of a country like Botswana contributes more per unit area to the economy than livestock does. And the whole dynamic has changed, which is very, very interesting. And it's helping us rethink disease management and rethink the balance in terms of land use planning between livestock-based and wildlife-based enterprises. So the history is one of wildlife really suffering. Hundreds of thousands of animals died because their migratory pathways were cut off by these fences. And I think in the next decade, we may start to see a rethink as countries are actually looking at creating bigger protected areas called peace parks, transfrontier conservation areas, which is something I work on now in my current job, where countries have seen that it's fascinating, but today, you know, 2010, as opposed to when I was there in the early 1990s, nature-based activities for the Southern African region, SADC, contribute more to the gross domestic product than forestry, fisheries, and agriculture combined. And that's truly a remarkable statistic, and that was pointed out by the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment a few years ago. So if photographic tourism and safari hunting are that valuable to GDP, well, it makes sense for the leaders of these countries to look at things like transfrontier conservation as a potential new engine of economic growth, and that's what's happening. At the same time, we're working, and we can talk more about this later on, but we're working with countries to look at new ways to control things like foot and mouth that don't necessarily require such extensive fencing. So you potentially are looking at some win-wins in the years to come that could improve, you know, development trajectories, food security, and as well as diversify livelihood opportunities, and potentially get away from what historically has been intensive conflict between livestock agriculture and wildlife conservation that goes back, as I said, many, many decades.
So let's talk about some of these win-win solutions. How could you protect livestock from foot and mouth disease without all these fences?
Well, the science has come a long way since these fences were put up largely by the donor community. And now we're starting to realize that instead of controlling it right now, if you're a Southern African country, you know, the OIE, the World Organization for Animal Health, basically says you can't export your meat to Europe unless you create disease-free zones, and hence the fencing. Now we know that if we quarantine livestock adequately for a certain amount of time, if they're going to have foot and mouth disease, we're going to be able to see it. And subsequent to a quarantine, if we process the meat properly, if we debone it, take out the lymph nodes, etc., age the beef properly as we would normally do, basically value-added process the meat, we can demonstrate that the virus can't survive that process. So using standard industrial practices that are in existence all over the world, you know, hazard management processes and food hygiene processes, and we can do two things. We can, first of all, help countries of origin, like Botswana, actually increase the amount of revenue they generate from their exports. In other words, instead of the importing country getting all the benefit by processing the products and then selling them at a higher price, we can do a lot of that processing at the point of origin. The country can make more money at the same time through science-based evaluation of food safety and the evaluation of how viruses like foot and mouth react to different types of management. We can demonstrate that the meat is a safe product without necessarily requiring these vast system defenses. It's called commodity-based trade, and it's in existence in other parts of the world. And the Southern Africans are starting to realize that all kinds of trade opportunities can be opened up if they develop these capacities in partnership with the private sector. And I think that over time, the OIE and the WTO are going to be more and more comfortable with this as the science demonstrates that this is actually safe. And the investments, the subsidies that have gone into the fencing and veterinary controls over the years have been hugely costly for these countries and often subsidized by donor countries. And a lot of that won't be necessary if we use these newer procedures and maintain what we would consider normal, you know, meat processing and hygiene practices. It could be a win-win. And as I said, erase decades of conflict where livestock agriculture and wildlife really were at odds because of the fencing issue.
And then as a going back to your job as the first wildlife vet in Botswana, can you tell about some of the first things that you did that related to some of these fencing issues?
Yeah. And I had so many interesting experiences. And related to fencing specifically, at one point, a very large herd of buffalo broke through one of these disease control fences, which is a big deal in Botswana. And for the first time in the history of the country, the veterinary authorities let us intervene. Normally, the response would be to go out and shoot all the buffalo immediately to prevent them from potentially infecting any livestock. But because now we had a wildlife veterinary unit in the country, I asked if we could go ahead and capture the buffalo and move them back across while they mended the fence. And we were given permission to do that. And we mounted a massive operation, which involved ground-based support, helicopter, fixed-wing aircraft to help spot the buffalo, all those things. And we succeeded in catching a lot of buffalo. I don't think I ever had so many animals anesthetized at the same time, and moving them back across.
So how did you do that? Because if you're anesthetizing dozens of animals at the same time, and then how many people were involved? This sounds like massive.
Yeah, it was really a massive recruitment. I actually brought in colleagues from the Department of Animal Health, not the Department of Wildlife, because I was the only vet in the Department of Wildlife, many of whom didn't have any experience like this, and so it was very much on-the-spot training. I had them doing some of the monitoring once animals were anesthetized, but we initially tried to catch the buffalo in what's called a boma, which is like a big funnel made of like tent material, where you chase the animals into a tunnel and into a holding area with a helicopter. But we couldn't get them to go in the boma. They were so skittish, they'd been so harassed by the time we got there, that we had to divert to plan B, which was darting individual buffalo, which was not what I wanted to do. But as buffalo were down, I assigned other staff to monitor them, to keep them in the correct anatomic position so they wouldn't bloat, so they could breathe. And then we'd back trucks up to them and put them on. I had a special stretcher that I had actually bought from the States that could, if you had enough people on it, you could lift hundreds and hundreds of pounds. It's made specially for zoo and wildlife animals. And we were able to lift animals onto trucks one at a time. When the trucks were loaded, I would reverse all the animals, meaning I would give them an antidote. They would get up. And then once everybody was standing up, then we could drive that truck back to where the point of origin was. And so we did this with several groups. It was a massive exercise. And it was more as important symbolically as anything else, because it showed that the buffalo were a valued resource, that just shooting them wasn't necessarily the best response. It made the papers, and I think it made people think about the value of wildlife, where historically, as I said, whenever this had happened in the past, the response had been lethal. And here the government, obviously I was working for the government wildlife department, was mounting a different type of response. At the same time, I collected blood from all those animals. Here they are, buffalo, and they carry various strains of foot and mouth, and I was very curious to know, not having opportunities to handle them very much before. And I was about to get them all tested at the Botswana Vaccine Institute, which is the best place to do that type of work at the time. And the director of veterinary services, which is not part of the wildlife department, it's part of the Ministry of Agriculture at the time, stopped me. She said, look, no, we don't want to know. We don't want these lab results run. And I was reprimanded for even thinking of doing those analyses. Now, in my mind, good science is never something that we should be afraid of. And I thought it was really important to get some updated information on the strains of foot and mouth. But the sensitivities about even the fact that these buffalo had foot and mouth getting into the media were so high that those samples were never, as far as I know, they were never analyzed at that time.
Oh, that's really interesting. I mean, it makes sense because the economy was based so much on beef exports at that time. So it's interesting to see that this switch where they were wanting you in there or letting you be in there and not killing those animals.
Yeah, and it was a gradual process, and it's continued over the years. You know, everybody knew those buffalo carried foot and mouth. My inquiries were more to get more detailed information on the different serotypes, the different types of virus. But you're absolutely right. The fact that we did as much as we did was a sea change in terms of the way wildlife had been viewed, you know, previously.
And what were some other I wanted to talk more about some of your other experiences. What was your sort of most challenging experience as a vet there?
Well, every one of our operations had its own challenges. I think one of the craziest experiences we had, I was asked to help move some giraffe from Naipan National Park to the Maun Educational Park in the northern part of the country. They wanted more giraffes in the Maun Educational Park. Maun is an important, you know, northern town. Now it's the main, you know, it's the main tourist city in the northern part of the country. And there's a small park right near town where a lot of school kids could go, and they wanted more giraffes. And so because wildlife veterinary medicine was new to the wildlife department, I used everything. Part of my role was training. So every exercise was a training exercise. All the staff that I hired over time was new to these issues. They were new to the wildlife department, many of them. And, you know, maybe some of your listeners wouldn't realize this, but a lot of folks who joined the wildlife department came from urban areas and had never seen their own wildlife. A lot of my staff had never seen an elephant, for example, till they joined the wildlife department. So there was a lot of training to do. So on the case of giraffe are one of the most challenging animals to safely capture.
Why?
Because of their anatomy and their physiology, those long necks, the dangers that they have when they fall asleep from the drugs. They can hurt themselves. They have blood pressure issues. And so I wanted to make sure that we did this the best way we could. So I called one of my friends and colleagues, Pete Morkel, who was still one of the best-known wildlife capture experts in the region. And he was, at the time, renowned for his giraffe capture expertise. And I called Pete and I said, look, I want you to come in. We've got to move, you know, probably three or four giraffe, and we don't have any of the equipment. You need a special trailer to safely transport a giraffe. And I know he was in Namibia at the time. They had, like, custom-made giraffe capture equipment and trailers and special masks for the giraffes and all these things that they'd worked out. So
yes.
He said, great. Yeah, I actually ended up making these masks myself. You want to keep the animal specially blindfolded, and to get it to stay on their head during a long ride, I actually had a pattern that I got from a book, and my wife Karen and I sewed these things and made these special masks. But anyway, I called Pete, and we set it up, and I got approval to pay for Pete's time, and I asked Pete to bring his best custom-made giraffe transport trailer so that everything would go swimmingly. So when the appointed time came, I met Pete at the border, and he showed up, and there was no trailer. I said, Pete, where's the giraffe trailer? That was the whole, you know, we need this. He said, ah, don't worry about it. And Pete is sort of make do with whatever. I mean, you give Pete some popsicle sticks and some chewing gum, and he can make a Boeing 747. And that's sort of the way he operated. But I really, this was a high profile project, and I really was quite upset that he didn't bring the equipment that I'd requested. He said, don't worry about it. We'll go into town and we'll see what we can find. And I won't belabor the story, but we ended up going to a junkyard, and he found the back of an old Land Rover, basically an axle, two wheels, and the back of a pickup truck. And he haggled with somebody and bought it. And then we hitched it to the back of our truck and went off somewhere and got some welding equipment. And then we spent the next day or two, as I recall, building a giraffe capture trailer out of this old rusty back of a pickup truck.
What is special about a giraffe trailer?
Well, if you think about the size of a giraffe, it has to be fairly tall up above their shoulders because they can really move those legs. And once you capture them and get them in the trailer, which is an ordeal in itself, then they've got to be sort of restrained so that they can't stick a leg out, break a leg, break a neck, whatever it is. So this is what you're picturing is sort of a very tall transport vehicle that's got bars along all sides and that can be closed up, and the animal is then sort of harnessed like a horse to the vehicle so it can't spin around or anything like that. Anyway, we got some wood and we welded the floor, and then we got logs, literally logs, and built the sides that I'm describing to you. And we had Pete made a capture trailer. Okay. I mean, it wasn't the way I wanted to do it, but as I said earlier, you know, when, you know, making do with locally available materials is pretty, pretty good skill to have.
And then would you be able to keep that trailer?
Well, the plot thickens. So anyway, we went out to Naipan, and I was trying to catch fairly young, not so big giraffes so that they could grow up in Maun Wildlife Park and, you know, live a long time and breed eventually. But it was often hard to judge from the helicopter, you know, what the size of the giraffe was relative to the other giraffes. And I ended up darting a fairly large bull as our first giraffe. And he went down fine, but he was full size. We decided to keep him. Pete thought we could transport him. And getting him in the trailer, I mean, once it involves a lot of cowboy work. I mean, it's not like a lot of other animals. The way we were catching giraffe at that time, there was a lot of rope work involved once they were darted. And a lot of my trainees, a lot of my guys, I have pictures of this. A lot of them ran away when we were roping this animal and putting it in the trailer. It was not a pretty sight. But that's on the ground training, so to speak, you know, because it's scary. This giraffe is flailing around a bit and they can kick in all sorts of directions. And I've got – Karen took a series of pictures. First there was like 20 guys. And by the end of the series of pictures, there's like three guys left in the frame.
I remember those pictures.
Yeah, I think you've seen them. So anyway, we get this very large giraffe bull in the trailer, and we hitch it up to the vehicle. And we've got – I don't remember. I think it was like 5-6 hour drive to get to Maun. We couldn't go very fast, and only part of the road was paved. And within an hour of being on the road with this giraffe, who was very calm, you know, he was blindfolded, he had cotton in his ears, again, minimizing stimuli so that they stay as calm as possible, smoke started to come out of the wheels of the trailer. And Pete was sort of sitting back there with the giraffe, and I was driving, as I recall. And, you know, Pete waved me down, and it was clear that this half of a pickup truck was in a junkyard for some very good reasons. The axle bearings were long shot, and it certainly wasn't meant to carry, you know, the whatever this giraffe weighed, 800 pounds, 900 pounds, I don't know. And so we had to improvise, because here we were now, we were outside of the protected area. We weren't near a national park anymore, but yet we had a wild giraffe with us. And it was no longer drugged. I mean, it was awake. It was just calm because of the blindfold and the earplugs. I think I had it partially sedated. And so Pete said, do you have any vegetable oil? And we had cooking oil, you know, when we were, you know, camping out. And to make a long story short, we took an IV bag, you know, a bag of fluids, emptied it out, and the IV drip line, and filled the bag with vegetable oil, and then set up an IV drip into the wheel bearings so that as we were driving, the vegetable oil would lubricate the axle and prevent it from getting red hot and starting a fire. And that's what we did the whole way. We had the giraffe was fine. The vehicle was in intensive care. And this thing, people were driving by, looking at us, scratching their heads. They probably, a lot of them had never seen an IV drip, never mind one being given to a truck. But we made it, and we got the giraffe out of the trailer. We had a pen at the destination, and we got it out. And it was definitely a lesson in how to do things in Africa. And it did work, but I've never really forgiven Pete for that ordeal, I must say. And we still talk about it. I still see him.
Did you get any more giraffes than that one?
Yeah, I think we ended up catching two or three. And I'm pretty sure that if you go to the Maun Wildlife Park today, the giraffes that are there are the descendants of that group.
Really?
I think so. Yeah, I don't think they've moved any in since.
That's really interesting. What was your most dangerous experience? Or I presume they were all pretty dangerous, really.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's really important about being a wildlife veterinarian is knowing – you know, where the risks lie, both for you and your patients. And, you know, every operation had its dangers. We were doing a lot with aircraft in difficult areas. We had very good helicopter pilot at the time and a very good fixed-wing pilot. Some of the most dangerous work definitely involved elephants. We had to do a lot of elephant radio collaring in those years. And, you know, we were often trying to figure out where elephants were moving at different times of the year. In order to do that, you would often target the matriarch, the lead female, because she would be most representative of the major movements of the herd. Well, if you think about it, if you dart the head female of a herd of elephants, the rest of the group isn't that happy about it, and it really is quite distressing for them. And it's hard to watch and participate in because they don't know what's happening. They see the female get darted. There's a helicopter usually. Sometimes we work from the ground, but usually we're using a helicopter. And then the animal falls down asleep, but they don't know. They don't know if it's dead. They don't know what's happening. So there's really panic among the herd. And the matriarch often has a calf or several calves from several years. And so you have to use the aircraft to push the rest of the herd away so you can get close enough quickly to make sure the animal's okay, administer any other drugs that you need, and to do your work, to put the radio collar on, take your measurements, get your blood. And so there was a constant vigilance that was needed, and we always had somebody armed in case things really got out of hand so that you could keep the rest of the herd away while you were handling the head elephant. And that was kind of hairy because you knew that nearby there was a group of elephants that was very, very angry. And it was the job of the fixed-wing aircraft and some other members of the team to keep in touch and let us know if they were successful in keeping the rest of the herd away. And we were very successful. We did dozens of elephants, and we never had a problem. I will say, before I had never done elephant work before, even in a zoological setting. So I did a lot of reading beforehand, and I talked to a lot of my colleagues in the region. And I remember reading – I can't remember what book it was, but from many years ago, someone said, you know, 1 in 10 elephants – will charge you immediately upon administration of the antidote. And I think this was a book written in the 70s. And I thought, oh, 1 in 10, that's interesting. Well, by coincidence, on our 10th elephant, after the first 9 had gone very, very well, for some reason, and then something did go wrong, the pilot and I had not coordinated properly. What we always did was I would signal to the pilot to get the rotors spinning, to get the main, get the helicopter running before I administered the antidote, so that in the couple minutes it took the elephant to wake up, we could then run to the helicopter and take off and be safe. Well, I don't remember exactly what happened, but for some reason, I think I gave the signal and the pilot missed it. Or anyway, the helicopter wasn't turning and burning, as we like to say. It wasn't doing anything, and I had administered the antidote. Okay, so the elephant got up before the helicopter was even on. And yes, okay, number 10, this is the one that decided to charge.
Of course.
And so me and my team, ran behind the helicopter, and I remember one of my assistants fell on the ground. The pilot was sitting in the helicopter, jumped out instead of continuing to try to turn it on. He jumped out, and I stood my ground, and the helicopter was open on both sides. The doors were off because we were doing capture work. And this elephant stuck its head in the helicopter through one side. I was on the other side, and I just spread my arms out to make myself look as intimidating as I can. And I'm not a very intimidating guy. But I was screaming and waving my arms, and that elephant looked me in the eye. And all she had to do – we were in the middle of nowhere. All she had to do with her tusks was just turn her head a little bit. She would have destroyed the helicopter. But she looked at me. She backed out. We were literally probably 2 feet from each other, and she walked away. And that was the 1 in 10 elephant that charges. And luckily for us, she decided it wasn't worth her effort, and she went back to the herd. And I picked up my game scout who had fallen down and had a big cut on his knee, and the pilot scraped up, and we started up the helicopter and went away. And that never happened again. We never had that kind of miscommunication again. But could have been – it's a fun story in retrospect. It could have gone much worse, obviously. Right. So lesson learned.
Wow.
I'll just never forget her head in the door of that helicopter just looking at me, and I'm thinking, I don't have any other options. I knew I didn't want to run. If you run from a charging elephant, chances are you're going to get pinned down and crushed. So they say to stand your ground, and you rarely get tested in life to know whether you will stand your ground or whether you're going to panic. And luckily, I didn't panic. And that's certainly a situation I'll never forget.
Wow. Yeah, because how would you remember to stand your ground in that situation?
I just knew that running would have been a fatal mistake. And people have made that mistake. And there's no guarantee that standing your ground always works either. I mean, it happened to work here, and so we're telling this story. But
thankfully.
it's dangerous work. There's no question.
What was your favorite experience, or the one with sort of the most impact, either on people or a species?
I think there's a lot of it was very rewarding. I think some of my most enjoyable work was we were doing some work with problem predators at the time, and working with farmers to help them, instead of shooting cheetah, for example, who were taking either game farm animals or livestock, to let us catch them and move them and then try and see if that was a successful strategy. And I remember working with some farmers out in Hansi District, out in the West, who traditionally would shoot predators. And I got to know them, and they said, okay, well, if you can catch them and take them away, we'll let you do that. And we, I remember taking one cheetah across the country releasing it in Naipan. And Naipan is a beautiful – it's a pan. It's a very flat area, sort of golden sea of grass at the right time of year. And we had this cheetah in a trap, and we had had to anesthetize it, to radio collar it and make sure it was healthy. And we camped out with it that night. We wanted to release it in the daytime so we could see what it did. And overnight, we were in our tent, and we were right near the cheetah. And I remember her at night, she was making sort of a calling noise, like, and it was a very, very sort of moving noise. It was sort of sad but inquisitive. You knew she was calling out to somebody. And that morning, we brought her – we had her in an area where we wanted her to see the prey base. There were a lot of springbok and impala in the area. And I remember I hooked up a rope so that we could open this crate from a distance so that she wouldn't be as disturbed by us. And we watched her at sunrise walk out of this crate right into a giant herd of springbok. And the springbok – I don't know when the last time they saw a cheetah was, but it was kind of like – very much like in the movie The Ten Commandments where Moses parts the Red Sea. Uh-huh. These springbok split right in the middle very slowly, and there was this road, this path that appeared. And the cheetah very regally walked straight through the herd. She wasn't hunting. She was too disoriented. You know, this was a new place for her. She'd been in a crate, and she just was looking around, and the springbok were looking back at her. But you could see the respect – that the springbok, they knew this was a cheetah. They knew this was a predator. And that you could see that there was an equilibrium potentially being reestablished. And that cheetah was tracked by the warden for a while. And she stayed in the area for a while. And then I recall she ended up moving to another part of the of that part of Botswana. But it was nice to give that cheetah another chance and to see that process unfold a bit.
Do captured animals that are translocated usually stay in their new area or not?
You know, there's a huge body of research on this. And frankly, the translocation of predators in particular, like the cheetah, it's really not a great strategy. It's often the strategy of last resort, which it was in our case. You can, you know, restore predators, but it's a complex endeavor. And some of the successful programs have been when the destination was a fenced area. Naipan National Park wasn't fenced, and so that cheetah had free roam. And often animals want to go back to where they came from. So there's a whole science of translocation and reintroduction and understanding the destination source and the habitat and the food base.
And you were also involved in translocation of rhinos.
Yeah, that was another program I was going to mention as sort of, you know, one that certainly stays with you. You know, very interesting. When I started in the early 1990s in the wildlife department, the wildlife department had been not the strongest department. They had didn't have a lot of internal expertise at the time. They were relying a lot on expatriates, and that didn't always work out. There was a wildlife biologist who was actually not from Botswana, who was in charge of rhinos. And I mean, I hate to say this, but it was very clear that he really wasn't doing the research that was being reported. There were reports saying there were hundreds of rhinos, and the history, I should back up, the history was that in the 70s, rhinos had pretty much been wiped out of Botswana by poaching. We're talking about white and black rhinos for the most part. And then South Africa donated more rhinos to Botswana. They translocated them up the Natal Parks Board, brought them up. And so if you looked at the math, there should have been hundreds of rhinos if they had not been poached. But at the same time I started, there was a Swiss expat hired to revamp the anti-poaching unit. And he started to really go out into remote areas, which really the wildlife department hadn't been visiting in any regular way. And he started to find a lot of old rhino carcasses. And it was very clear. He and I were comparing notes because we were getting out into the bush. And it was very clear there weren't hundreds of rhinos left in Botswana. In fact, there were hardly any. And this information, we got this information out, and there was a controversy. Why had the reports been so positive? And then they wanted to blame the anti-poaching guy. They said he must be the one killing them. It really got ridiculous. But eventually, you know, some outside NGOs got interested, and it became very clear that basically the poaching had continued, but nobody really had paid attention to it or knew about it. And it became very clear that Botswana was on the verge of losing her rhinos again in the early 1990s. And to make a long story short, I was part of a group that within the government who recommended that we quickly get in some expertise on rhino capture. Again, the Botswana Wildlife Department had never done rhino capture. We didn't have any of the right equipment. Certainly the special crates and trucks and cranes and things you need to move a heavy animal like that. So we contacted the Natal Parks Board, who really had led the region in terms of their expertise on rhino capture. And I actually brought some of my team down to Natal and did some capture work with them to get a handle on what they were doing. And then we invited them up after having done some aerial surveys and found the last handful of white rhinos in the country. They were literally, less than a dozen, as I recall. And our mission was to catch the rhinos and bring them to a safe location. And at the same time, a local organization in the central part of the country called Saroe had come together to build a sanctuary to support the rhinos at this time of intensive poaching. And they built what they called the Kama Rhino Sanctuary, named after Sir Seretse Khama, the first president of Botswana, whose son is now the current president of Botswana. And this rhino sanctuary, when we started, it was very small. I mean, we just were able to get up bomas, big wooden holding pens, just in time to receive the rhinos we were going to capture. Now, today, it's a very large park with an external fence, and they've translocated a lot of species in, including black rhinos, and it's become a tourist destination. But at the time, it was almost an emergency location. And one of the reasons it was a good place to go was it was away from international boundaries. Botswana's landlocked, and a lot of the poaching was coming over from Zambia, for example. And so to get away from the border was a good thing. So we spent several weeks in reconnaissance, and I went out and got familiar with some of the remote areas and some of the trails, and figured out, you know, how we could most efficiently catch these animals. And this was the most massive operation we launched. It involved, you know, giant trucks and multiple teams, and as before, aircraft and helicopters. And we caught all the rhinos. Now, at the time we were doing it, I think, you know, there was definitely – poaching was still going on. I mean, there were one of the animals that we caught had fresh bullet wounds in it. It was really clear that someone knew we were trying to catch the last few rhinos, and they wanted to get the last few horns that they could. And I remember this one calf. He was probably a couple of years old. He had, you know, a wound in his shoulder or a wound in his head, but there was really no good way to know, you know, whether those bullets were lodged and not causing a huge problem or whether they'd done serious internal damage. And, you know, I think, as you know, I wrote a chapter about the capture of this rhino and how we had to manage him medically once we had him in our holding bomas with his compatriots, and the challenges of managing traumatic injuries from bullet wounds. Again, not having x-rays, not having CAT scans, having minimal diagnostic capabilities. And it was a very moving experience, because these rhinos were really suffering at the hand of man. They had done nothing to bring this tragedy on themselves. And on the positive side, this got a lot of attention in the local media. Botswana was trying to save her rhinos. People knew the history, that they'd lost the country's rhinos in the past, and they weren't going to let it happen again. And looking back now, there have now been rhinos moved back into the wilderness. They are heavily monitored. And today there are, again, wild rhinos in Botswana as well as in the sanctuary. And that wouldn't be the case had we not mounted that rescue operation. I think had we not acted when we did, the remaining rhinos undoubtedly would have been killed, and there would be no rhinos in Botswana anymore.
Now, there's been an upsurge lately in rhino poaching again. Has Yes. Botswana experienced that as well? You hear a lot of reports in South Africa, I know.
The poaching is less of a problem in Botswana right now, and not only does the Wildlife Department have they invested in an anti-poaching unit, but the Botswana Defense Force has anti-poaching capabilities as well, and the intense poaching has been in South Africa in places like Kruger, and it's surged to levels that we haven't seen in decades, and part of it is driven by Asian markets and wealth that creates demand, and I hate to say it, but you know, as we have a much more intense Asian presence, a Chinese presence, for example, in these countries, we are seeing more ivory being intercepted, more horn being intercepted, and so there is a relationship between Asian wealth and an interest in these products and poaching pressure. It's all supply and demand, and right now the demand is high, and wildlife is paying a big price again. Zimbabwe has also been hit very hard, not only because of the Asian demand, but because their capabilities under the current, you know, collapse have been greatly diminished. They have virtually no resources to work with. And so anti-poaching is very weak, and poachers are taking advantage of that.
That's all the time we have now, but we'll continue the conversation. In the meantime, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks again.
I hope you enjoyed those insights into life as the first wildlife vet in Botswana with Dr. Steve Osofsky. Next week, we'll continue our discussion and talk about how his experiences in Botswana made him realize the need to consider wildlife, livestock, and human health all together, and how doing that can help make wildlife conservation a rational and economically profitable land use choice. Now, let me play you today's creature call once again and see if you've guessed it correctly. This animal is the largest living land mammal and can be found across the plains of Africa, from Botswana and other southern African countries to Kenya and Tanzania and beyond. Have you guessed it yet? It's the African elephant, one of the big five animals sought after on photographic safaris. Now, listen to the trumpeting of the African elephant. Next week's Creature Call, I'll move to Central Africa, where scientists and local people are working together to save these endangered primates from extinction. Now, here's your preview. Be sure to tune in next week when I'll replay this strange sound from the wild world and reveal the animal that made it. Archived episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnimi.com, and at laurelnimi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnimi.com. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nimi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.